Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Eric's Guide to Ancient Egypt. And today we're going to be talking about mummification. But before we start on mummification, I do need to give a little bit of an update. Last week, we did our podcast on King Tut, where we focused specifically on Tutankhamun and his life, his death, what we've learned about him, some of the more recent things. And then we got into the controversy around his tomb a little bit, whether or not there might actually be a hidden chamber. And of course, the day I posted that podcast, there was another news cycle item that was quickly picked up. So I wanted to just go into that briefly before we start on mummification. An Egyptian official came out and said that while they can't see that there's a tomb inside, that they believe that there is actually a storehouse, that that's what one of these rooms might be. I don't know how reliable I would consider that source. I personally haven't heard that they've actually opened the tomb yet or inserted a camera or anything like that. My understanding is that that's probably going to be done this upcoming month in March. And then I think we're going to have an announcement about things in April. At least that's what I've been hearing. So I would think that that's probably around what the rough timeline is for how we're going to see things. But it certainly is exciting that somebody who's highly placed within the Egyptian government is saying that this is something where we actually are going to have a room filled with objects. So I just wanted to give that quick update, and I actually think it's a really good segue into what we're going to talk about today, which is mummification. Because mummification really highlights that the ancient Egyptians were not only preoccupied or even obsessed with death, but it shows us how they responded to that obsession. You know, it's funny, like everything else, scholarship moves in circles and in patterns, and you'll have ideas that are popular at a certain time that might fall out of favor. And one of the things I remember seeing, or you can still see it as you go through older publications, you know, 20, 30 years ago, you'd see a lot of publications that would say things like, the Egyptians weren't obsessed with death, they were obsessed with life. And it was their love of life that led them to invest all of this money and all of this effort into preparing for an afterlife. And I don't know that I'd really agree with that. I think very clearly the Egyptians were obsessed with death. Now, they could be obsessed with death because their life was so good that they wanted it to continue in a similar form in the afterlife. But we do see that the idea of the afterlife is not exactly existing as they would have existed on Earth. The afterlife itself is an altered state of existence, and ideally, it's a state where an individual is going to be transfigured or transformed into an Ankh, or an effective spirit. And this spirit then becomes integrated completely into the cosmic cycle. They can go and join the sun god. They become a divine being. And this is something that's a little bit different than, oh, they're going to enter an afterlife that's much like this one. Now, the Egyptians really believed in multiple destinations and in multiple answers. They didn't have any sort of sense of a religious canon. So there wasn't this is the one afterlife you could go to. There was a field of offerings, and there was the solar cycle that you could join. And there were also the circumpolar stars, and you could become Osiris. So there were different things happening. And we even have spells where the individual who would become that effective spirit, that Ankh spirit, would transform themselves into an animal. They could come back in the form of a crocodile or a bird and things like that. So I don't want to give you the impression that there was just one answer. But the reason that this relates to mummification, and the reason that it relates to that tomb of King Tut, is because what we can see is that the Egyptians were not only afraid of death and concerned about the afterlife, but they dealt with that fear and they dealt with that crisis in material terms. So what do I mean by that? Well, the fact that the mummification process itself is designed to create the body as an immortal vessel. They built these huge tombs. They took daily life objects with them because there was the belief you would need these material objects in the next world, that somehow your ability to live as an effective spirit or in the netherworld or on the solar bark of Ray was tied to material objects and material circumstances that you held during life. More objects, a bigger tomb, means you have access to more of those things, and that's a good thing, at least in the Egyptian mindset. So, this is where we can see that all of that monumental building architecture, all of the mummification, all of the jewelry, it actually had a functional purpose. Of course, there was no doubt social pressures that contributed to this as well. Building a huge tomb, building a huge pyramid, that's also a way of reflecting and enhancing the status that you held in life. So it's certainly multi-layered, but no need to go into too much social theory. So first, when we talk about mummification, what you need to understand, or at least what I should say is my understanding that I think can help understand why the Egyptians dealt with death in this way, is that when you were alive, your body was completely united with your soul, with your spirit. Everything was all together. And when you die, there's a fragmentation of your being. And that fragmentation then requires different specific approaches to sustain that one piece of your personality or that one piece of your being in the afterlife. So just to give you an idea of some of the conceptions the Egyptians had of death. First, what we're going to be talking about today, death was seen as a physical dismemberment. Your body was torn apart. But it wasn't just about your body. Death is also social isolation. It's the dissociation of all your personality elements and all of those elements of your being. It's a severance and a parting from all social bonds. Death is really the enemy for the ancient Egyptians, and it's an enemy that needs to be overcome. And then you have the process of the afterlife as well, that death then becomes a journey to the beyond. It becomes a mystery and an initiation where you're going to learn the secrets of Osiris or the secrets of the solar cycle, and you're going to become one with those gods and become part of their retinue. And it can even be a homecoming where you're greeted as a part of that family and of that retinue, in addition to your ancestors who live on after you, who are going to still take care of you and hold you and worship you. So, let's talk about some of the different aspects of your personality. The main one we're going to be focusing on today is the body, your corpse. That is definitely one of the central elements of your body, or rather, that's one of the central elements of your personality. But you also have your heart. And your heart for the ancient Egyptians was seen as the place where all of your memories were. It was seen as the place of your, I don't want to say soul because they had a different conception for that, but it was seen the way we would think of it as your brain. It was where your thoughts and your emotions came from. That soul concept, we would say, is your ba. And the Egyptians would usually draw that as a human-headed bird. You also had your name, and your name was actually seen as a distinctive personal element. It was something that was tied to you. We also have your ka, which we would think of as your life force. And then we have your shuti, or your shadow. And that's probably the least understood of all of these different elements. It has to do with the solar cycle and seeing that the sun would actually have you cast a shadow. But that's the element that I think we understand the least, and that the Egyptians themselves seem to pay the least amount of attention to. So, why do we need a mummy? Well, the Egyptians drew their inspiration from nature. And that's something that we see throughout Egyptian philosophy and throughout Egyptian thought. They really were inspired by the natural environment. And going back early into the pre-dynastic period, so before Egypt is unified and before we actually have the two lands united into one kingdom, we see that for a long time, the Egyptians are burying their dead, which is common in many cultures. They're taking their dead. They're burying them, usually in small oval-shaped pits. They're burying them sometimes wrapped in a reed mat, sometimes with animal skins. And they're burying them with some jars, sometimes rings or copper ingots, small items that tell us the Egyptians were already one, seeming to have the idea of an afterlife. Now, this all predates written texts, so we can't say this is what they thought, but they're providing them with goods for the afterlife. And we also start to see over time, at least in some of the pre-dynastic communities, that the Egyptians already maybe are turning a little bit towards a solar phase. We start to see that bodies that are, again, buried in pits, often in a fetal position, laying on their left side with their hand in front of their face, facing to the east. And we think that this might be a form of early solar worship, and perhaps already an example of that idea that the sun god dies and is reborn every day, and that these deceased are facing east to that moment of rebirth when they themselves want to be reborn. Well, unlike many different cultures where the body is going to decay, it's going to die, in ancient Egypt, they're burying these individuals out in the desert, away from the cultivatable wet land. And of course, Egypt being dry and it being desert, the bodies became, in many cases, mummified, and mummified just by nature, simply through the desiccation that was taking place over time as a result of the heat and the dryness. And this was the inspiration for the Egyptians to then actually begin the process of mummification themselves. And the Egyptians became masters of mummification. And one of the things that we're going to talk a little bit about today is the fact that when it comes to mummification, it evolved over time. There were different processes. It seems to have hit a high point in the New Kingdom, but there were different techniques, different types of wrapping. So there really wasn't one way to make a mummy. And when we talk about what we mean by the mummification process and what they're doing, we're often going to talk about the ideal process, but then I'll also go into some of the other processes that maybe weren't so ideal, but that would get the job done. So they see that in nature, they see that natural body, and they think, well, we should be doing this process. We should be enhancing it. We can make the individual into an image and into a corpse that will last forever. And this is actually important because the Egyptians believed that your body in life was the place where all these elements of your personality would become joined together. And in death, they've dissociated. These elements are now moving about on their own. But certain elements like the ka or the ba actually need to return to the body. They need the body as a resting place, or as a place where, for instance, your ka or your spirit might come to rest and receive offerings. So the body does serve a purpose. And the mummification process itself is also then related to the story of Osiris, who was murdered, his body dismembered. So as the Egyptian priests are mummifying an individual, they're actually symbolically recollecting those body parts. And this is done because many of the funerary rituals are aimed at likening or turning the deceased person into Osiris. And the reason why is because Osiris was seen as the preeminent example of how an individual was going to overcome death. Osiris was the one who did it. Yes, he was a god, but he died. He was killed. He was dismembered. His body parts scattered throughout the country. And then his wife, sister, Isis, brings those parts back together, is able to revivify him. And he then no longer exists in this world, but he is in the next world. And in the next world, he is a king. And so the Egyptians are looking at that as inspiration. So for those who want to go to the next life, Osiris is the way to do it. You want to be like him. So we're making this eternal container for your ba and your ka. and were turning the body into a divine image, the image of Osiris. So how do we do that? Well, we have a couple different steps. First, we have the removal of your heart, your brain, your internal organs, all of those kind of squishy things that are going to maybe putrefy, that are going to really spoil. They're getting rid of those. Well, I shouldn't say getting rid of them. We're removing them. Some we'll get rid of, some we'll keep, as we'll talk about in a moment. So at this point, they're cleaning the body, they're removing the internal organs, and of course, we've got some great specifics here that most people may have already heard of or known about. So the brain, we don't really see them keeping it. They take a copper wire with a little hook, they poke it up through the nose, they appear to scramble the brain, they really try to liquefy it to drain the brain out. And we see that there's actually some ritual involved in this. Some of the later texts tell us that in the process of mummification, where we're getting to the point where we're going to make a small incision on the side to take out some of those internal organs, we actually have a priest come in who's going to be dressed as Seth, who comes in and he makes that cut, and then he's chased out and they throw sticks at him and stones and things like that. But again, we're reenacting that death of Osiris. And we do need to take out those organs for full mummification the way the Egyptians wanted to do it. So after we've removed some of those organs, they're then going to dehydrate the body with natron or a natron solution for 70 days. And natron is like a naturally occurring baking soda salt type solution. And this is, again, ideal. And I say ideal because it's important to always remember when we're talking about tombs and we're talking about mummies, that none of this is happening for the average person. It's only the elite who are actually going to be formally mummified in this way. Most ancient Egyptians are still going to be in that old pit-style burial that we talked about, going back to the pre-dynastic period. So I don't want to give the impression that all Egyptians are able to afford, or that all Egyptians even were mummified, because certainly most of them were not. But they do seem to have similar beliefs and ideals and ideas. So back to our ideal mummification process. The body is then soaked in this natron solution. Once we then take it out, we see that the heart is actually replaced back into the body. And remember, I told you, the heart is one of these important elements of your personality. Your heart is the seat of all your memories and your thoughts and your emotion. So your heart is given really special treatment. It's wrapped and reinserted into the body. And we actually have a special Book of the Dead spell, or in Egyptian, the Book of Going Forth by Day, that actually, in a way, is meant to bind your heart. So one of the things that's going to happen after the mummification, and in theory this happens in the afterlife, is you're going to be led before Osiris. Osiris is a judge of the netherworld, and he's going to take that heart of yours, and he's going to weigh it against the feather of Ma'at, or the feather of truth. And if your heart is heavier than that feather, it's going to be tossed to a demon goddess named Amut, and she is part crocodile, part lion, part, but one of these ferocious amalgamations of God. She's going to devour your heart, right? And your heart is representing your thoughts, your mind, all of that. And this is something that would be considered by the Egyptians the second death, that you actually are now going to just simply be in oblivion forever. At least this is what some of the texts tell us. One of the things that we see is there is an idea that you can have evil dead spirits that can come back and cause problems for the living by haunting them, making them sick, things like that. So very clearly there were ways that individuals who weren't good still persisted, but no need to get too much into that now. So your heart is replaced back into the body. Often we're going to have a heart scarab, which would be inscribed with that spell for the Book of the Dead. And that spell, it's worth reading a little bit just because it really is fascinating. So that heart, we see that the spell actually says, "You shall not speak against me in the tribunal." And the idea seems to be that your heart actually could, when called upon by Osiris, say, "Oh yeah, we did these bad things, we did these bad things," and actually lead you to then be devoured, or at least your heart to be devoured, and then suffer that second death. So it's interesting that the Egyptians had a magical workaround for this issue of morality. And I think that's one of the fascinating things that we see with the preparation for the afterlife, is magical attempts to subvert morality. So the heart has been replaced in the body, and the body itself is then wrapped in linen. And this is actually one of the ways that we can kind of date mummies, because the different types of wrapping we can see changed and evolved over time. Usually, we're dealing with the entire body being wrapped as a single unit. So the popular image that you see in movies where the limbs are wrapped individually, the fingers kind of going all the way up where they have free movement, it's usually not the case. Usually, the hands are going to be placed at their sides or maybe on their chest, but really then you're just going to have the entire mummy eventually wrapped up as one kind of big package. Now, they don't throw away some of those organs that they kept. Your liver, your lungs, your stomach, your intestines, those they actually keep, and they place those in canopic jars. And those jars are referred to as the four sons of Horus, and these are protective deities. We've got a falcon and a baboon and a jackal and a human-headed one. We have those four sons, Hapi, Imseti, Kebesenuef, and Duamutef, and they're meant to protect these different organs. And again, this is not something the average person could afford, but if you were wealthy and could, you would have your organs placed in these jars, and then quite often placed inside a canopic chest, so a small chest that would then hold these four jars. Now, we're not just meaning and attempting to preserve the body, right? As we talked about, we're actually attempting to turn this into a divine image. And we have some other things that help us out in these kind of evolve over time. So we initially, as I said, maybe some reed matting, maybe some animal skins. By the time we get to the Old and Middle Kingdom, though, then we actually have coffins. And these are kind of like the coffins we see today. Rectangular wooden coffins. But towards the New Kingdom, we really start to see the adoption of anthropoid wooden coffins, or coffins that look like individuals. And these coffins, you can see, we do have gender associated with the coffins, but at least for men, they're taking on the visage of Osiris. You'll often see the skin on the face painted black or green. That has to do with green fertile vegetation or the black fertile soil of the Nile. Things that are associated with Osiris, because this is all part of the effort to make that body into a divine image and an eternal container for your Ba and your Ka. And then, of course, outside of these coffins, we actually get sarcophagus, which is great from the Greek for flesh eater. And these actually then are containers for those wooden coffins. So we actually have a huge amount of nesting. And when you look at some of the royal burials, like the one we have for King Tut, you can see that we actually have multiple of these coffins and sarcophagi, all of these different protective elements for the king. We see that visual depiction, at least with men, with Osiris. It's a little bit more confusing for women. And there's actually been some scholars who've written on this and speculate as to whether or not it's a challenge for women to move on into the afterlife. What we see textually is that women are also called Osiris. So one of the strategies that the individual uses is to adopt the name of Osiris. So let's say we're looking at my coffin. I'm wealthy enough to afford a coffin in ancient Egypt. We'll see text on it that will say, this Osiris Eric, born of usually the mother, because of course the mother's the one that you can really be sure who bore him. So for magical purposes, that's always the best one to go for. So we see that you're not only visually identifying the individual with Osiris, but textually. For women, they keep their gender and appearance. They're not shown as men, but they do have that textual association with Osiris, at least throughout most of Egyptian history. By the time we get to much later periods, and by much later I mean we're largely talking about the Greco-Roman period, there we actually see a goddess, Hathor, who we've talked a little bit about in past episodes, but she's a goddess of love and fertility. Hathor is actually called the Mistress of the West. The West, again, relating to that solar cycle. The West is the place where the sun sets, where it dies. So Hathor, the Mistress of the West, actually becomes a kind of female version of Osiris, and we see that women begin to associate with her. But I digress, back to the body itself. So these representations on the coffin, through text and through image, again are a way that we're creating a divine image. We're meant to, or rather we're... So these representations on coffins, through text, through image, are meant to integrate the deceased into the world of the gods by associating them with a god. And one of the best examples that we can actually see of that is through the funerary mask of King Tut. And that's something we talked a lot about last time. If you didn't download that podcast, you don't need to. But if you want to hear more about that mask, please go back there. But that is meant to represent the deceased as a god. Right? We see the divine beard, which is curved and not straight. We see the golden skin, and it's made out of gold, because the gods were said to themselves have skin of gold and bones of silver. So those are things that we actually do, again, artistically and materially see as attempts to help make it to the next world. It really is fascinating to me to see that the Egyptians dealt with so many of these crisis moments, like death itself, in a very material way. And the reason that's fascinating for me is I'm a social historian. I like to see and look at and try to speculate as to how ordinary individuals and society itself worked. Certainly we have important players, but I'm not somebody whose primary focus is to look at how did kings and viziers and generals vie for power. I'm very interested in the day-to-day life. I'm not interested in seeing that this individual took power from this individual. And in many ways, that largely wasn't going to affect society. That top-level change for 99% of people means nothing in their daily life. They're still going to be in their field. They're still going to be working as a farmer. They're still going to be working as a baker, as a potter. There's not going to be a huge amount of change. And I always wonder how it is that these individuals perceived of this system that was so focused on materiality and wealth. Did an ancient Egyptian who was maybe not even poor, but average, look at a huge tomb and all of that expense and think, wow, this is just wasteful? Or even more depressing, did they look and say, I've got no chance of making it to the afterlife because I don't have any of this wealth. I can't get a mummification, let alone my own coffin and sarcophagus and tomb. And of course, the taking care of the body doesn't end there, right? We already talked a little bit about the heart and how it was wrapped, and we've got Book of the Dead spell 30B that's going to help that heart be bound to not speak against you. Well, in addition to taking care of your body and your heart, we still have to take care of those other elements. So for instance, your ka, your life force. This was something that was seen as moving through generations and was kind of linked to your family. Now, it needs your mummy as a bodily container, as I said before. but its preservation also depends upon offerings. So you don't even just simply need a mummy and then your ka is set. You need individuals to continue to donate food and to offer food to you. Now, that can come in the form of actual food, which is probably preferable. You could also do what they call voice offerings, where you read an offering list and that offering list is supposed to magically transform itself into offerings for the ka. But life after death required individuals to keep giving. And we actually see that there's priests whose job it was to keep going to your grave after you've died and to give offerings and water offerings to you and different types of things to sustain you in the afterlife. And individuals would make endowments to these priests, and we can see them going through families where they would actually pay them to continue taking care of their deceased family members after they had passed away. Or really, I should say, not their deceased family members. Usually, individuals are making these contracts for themselves because probably they're maybe a little bit skeptical that they're going to continue to get these offerings from their family. Maybe they would say, you know, for a generation or two, my sons, my daughters, they'll take care of me, but not only might they forget, may they not remember, but it's easily possible that by the time you get to grandchildren, great-grandchildren who have no idea of who you are, they're not going to spend all their time in the necropolis making offerings to every deceased ancestor. So you had this formalized system of priests who would go and make these offerings for you. So moving past that taking care of the ka, we talked about how we've been turning the body through mummification and through the advent of coffin into a divine image. Well, the mummy that's been created now needs to be ritually activated. And what do I mean by that? Well, so far all we've still got is a container. But we need to perform a ritual that's going to allow that mummy to eat, to drink, and to breathe. And this is an important ritual in ancient Egypt called the opening of the mouth ritual. It's meant to be performed by your oldest son. If you don't have one, you would have a sempriest who you could pay to perform it for you. But what they do is they take some tools like a peshkef, and some people think this is a knife that looks kind of like a bee if you were to look at the blade. It has two ends for it that kind of dip in the middle. And this is a ritual where they're opening the mouth of the mummy to enable it to take in sustenance. And as part of this, they offer it the foreleg of an ox. And this is supposed to create food. And then they're also supposed to offer the heart, which is supposed to give it the pulse of life. So we see that you don't simply mummify the body and then it's effective. You need to perform this magic ritual on it to enable it to take in sustenance so that your ba and your ka can continue to live and exist with that container. And we shouldn't think that this is just poetic. We actually find food deposited within ancient Egyptian tombs. And it seems to be that there were regular presentations of offering at some of these tombs. And we can see that many of the tombs themselves are filled with text and representation of food offerings and of food production. And this, of course, is a kind of magical workaround where they're saying, okay, maybe people aren't going to come and continue to donate food, but I'm going to have a magical scene on my wall that shows them making beer forever. And that is going to magically produce beer for me forever. Because the Egyptians really believe that by depicting something, you gave it the magical power to come into being. So by having that entire production scene of how wheat maybe is going all the way into bread, or maybe how beer is made, the end result of that process is usually going to be offerings, and those offerings then become available to your ba and your ka. So the Egyptians, again, are really materially focusing on how they can deal with these. And one of the reasons I think that we can see that there was widespread belief in the materiality of the afterlife is because we see it reproduced at smaller levels. There are these beautiful things that we sometimes will call ba houses. And these are made out of clay, and they appear to depict tombs or perhaps large estates or houses. And they're made out of clay. They're the type of thing that if I gave any of you bits of clay now and said, you know, oh, make a little house, most of you could create things that were on the scale of this quality. We see those made for the deceased. We also have, again, for individuals who maybe couldn't afford beautiful tomb walls with scenes of food production, we see wooden models. Now, those, of course, we find within tombs, so these are individuals of some means, but maybe not the means to have that decoration plan they wanted. So they have models of individuals making food for them. And this, of course, leads to something that individuals are probably very familiar with, shabtis. And these shabtis evolve from servant statues, where from these models we see individuals grinding corn or individuals making the mash for beer. And by the time we get into the New Kingdom and later, the idea of the shabti, which is a figure that itself is mummiform, they're going to have their arms crossed over their chest in a very kingly pose that we normally see associated with Osiris. But this individual, usually you'll see them, they're holding hoes. They're meant to be slaves that are going to till the land for you forever. And we actually see them, some of them anyways, inscribed with a magical spell meant to bring this individual to life, to go and get offerings for you. So it's not just enough that you maybe have donations and you maybe have individuals offering to you from your family or maybe those priests. We also have these servant statues which are going to come to life and go and work for you. And ideally, you're going to have 365 of these, plus we're going to have an overseer for every 10-day week. So the Egyptians, you know, they're pretty serious about needing these individuals for the afterlife. And again, that shabti figure, which comes about in the New Kingdom, all comes out of these servant statues and these models of the agricultural and food-making processes that we see in the Middle Kingdom and even a little bit earlier. So we've taken care of the body. We've dried it out. We've got our organs in our canopic jars. We've got our anthropoid coffin, our sarcophagus. We've performed our opening of the mouth ritual so that the deceased actually can eat. Now, we need to provide So we've talked about the mummy. And we've talked about how the mummy is created, how then the opening of the mouth ritual is performed to allow it to eat and to drink. And I mentioned how this is done by symbolically cutting open its mouth, by offering it the foreleg of an ox, as well as offering it the heart. And this, in theory, is done right at the tomb. The mummy is then put inside. We already talked about how it's a container that the ka can go into. But as I said before, it's also something that the ba needs. It's also something that your soul needs. And we see texts that seem to indicate that for the Egyptians, your ba or your soul was able to go out and travel throughout the day. But at night, it needed to come and rest in your mummy. And this is probably something that, again, is tied to the solar cycle. Because what we see with the solar cycle is that the sun is born again at dawn every day, dies again at dusk, and then travels through the netherworld. Usually, the most common depiction is that the netherworld exists in the body of the sky goddess. But it needs to go back there because in the sixth hour of the night, in the darkest hour of the night, the Ba of the sun god, the soul of the sun god, is going to unite with the corpse of Osiris. And by getting access to that corpse of Osiris, there's a syncretism where the sun god Re now gets access to Osiris's regenerative powers. And then from that moment on, it's getting a little bit lighter, and the sun god is on his path to finish out those last 6 hours and be reborn. So that mythology is largely what we see represented in this idea that your own personal Ba needs to rest in your mummy at night. So far, we've talked about most of the elements needed for your body to be taken care of. We've talked about the mummy itself. We've talked about your Ba, your Ka. We've talked about the heart. But we haven't talked about the name. And the name is an interesting element of your personality. It's what makes you an individual. Of course, everybody's name is unique. But what we see in ancient Egypt is that it was thought that your life depended upon your name being preserved, that you just didn't need food and you just didn't need these different offerings. You actually needed your name to be remembered amongst the living. And we have many different inscriptions on the walls of tombs. For those who couldn't afford tombs, we often have stela, which are small things very much like tombstones. And these would bear the name of the deceased, along usually with an offering formula or some sort of text about them, sometimes autobiographical. And these often will have an appeal to the living that talk about reading this offering for them, that it's good for you, that you should make this voice offering, as I said before, something along the lines of something like, I give to Eric 100 jars of beer, 1,000 loaves of bread, things like that. Again, they're not overly elaborate, but they're meant to continue giving you offerings. And we also see that some of these also take the form of an offering table. And these are tables that would be flat where you would pour water over it. And that water being poured on the offering table was meant to ritually activate the offering spell there to then provide me or whoever the deceased was with those offerings. So these are all things that we see happening around the tomb. So these are all ways that we need to take care of what was once in your body in the afterlife. So for those of you who are dutiful listeners and you're now saying, okay, well, Eric, what about that sixth element? What about that shadow? As I said, we don't know too much about that. We don't see, at least I've never seen, something that's common across burials that's meant to take care of that element of your personality. But let's talk a little bit about the funeral itself, because I think that this is interesting. So we talked about the opening of the mouth ritual that's supposed to take place at the entrance of the tomb. But one of the more interesting things that we see is that we often will have depictions of wailing women as part of the funerary procession. And it's fascinating to me because, again, we see that in ancient Egypt, there were professional mourners that you could hire to go make it seem like you were a really great guy. These people are so sad. And these things really, I think, are so interesting because everybody would have known that these were professional mourners. They would have seen these women who were wailing and maybe pulling their hair. And we would see depictions of these women. They're usually pouring sand over their head, it looks like, or holding their hand up. They'd be crying, maybe pulling their hair. And everybody would have known that these individuals were hired to do this. They may not have even known the deceased. So I find these things to be very interesting that in the way that we think of weddings in Western society, that weddings become huge, huge examples of displays of wealth and power. I was listening to something on the radio before coming in, and it was talking about how, I think it was for Chelsea Clinton's wedding, that was a $3 million wedding. And they were talking about how Donald Trump, you know, gave Hillary Clinton a huge donation because he wanted her at his wedding. That is the type of thing that has nothing to do with those two young people usually getting married. Those young people are up there for each other, but the family needs to make a display. The family wants a display of wealth. They want powerful people there. They want this extravagance because that says something about them. Well, in ancient Egypt, I think that that would have been the funeral. The funeral was the place where that statement was made. The funeral was the place where you had an entire procession of people taking your coffin, taking your canopic jars, taking all of these offerings to the tomb. And this would have been a way that the Egyptians would have highlighted their place in society. And of course, this is to say nothing of the tomb itself. And for those of you who've looked online or on my Twitter or just are interested in Egypt, you can automatically think of how big and grandiose those tombs are, right? That's the Great Pyramids. Those are tombs. So these are all things that show that the Egyptian society really revolved around death and the display of death as a social display. And I don't say that to try to say that they didn't believe that these were afterlife destinations that you could go to, or that they didn't believe that you needed a body for your ka and your ba to rest in, and that you didn't need your name to exist among the living. No, they absolutely believed all of these things. But for this very religious people, religious spaces, and the funeral procession and the journey to the afterworld is absolutely a religious event, these became the places where individuals chose to highlight their social power. And these are the places where individuals chose to really engage in conspicuous social consumption. Now, I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about some of the backups that the Egyptians had. So, of course, as I said, when we're talking about mummification, we're talking about the ideal. The ideal person is going to have their organs removed. They're going to have the wrapping. They're going to have the canopic jars. But most people aren't getting that. And what might you say happens to an individual who's eaten by a hippo or a crocodile? Because that could happen. Well, there seem to be some different workarounds the Egyptians have. One thing is statues. We actually see specific statues called ka statues that serve as an idealized reserve body, for lack of a better term, of the deceased. This is a place where the deceased's ka could go if that body's not available. We can see them out of stone. We see them made out of wood. There seems to be some ideal that maybe you get a pass if you're eaten by, say, a crocodile, because that's associated with Sobek and it's a divine animal, and maybe that somehow can help you out. But we also have, again, these other material workarounds, these reserve bodies in the form of statues that your ka can go into. And we actually find these in tombs and tomb chapels. And the tomb chapel would be the area where individuals could actually interact. Once the body is inside the tomb, it's supposed to be sealed up, but we still need all these offerings, as I spoke about, right? So we usually would have some sort of public interface where individuals could go and make those water offerings. They could go and read that stela. So we'll often see that we have statues for the ka in those places. We even have what we call false doors in these places. And these are sculptural representations of doorways that are meant to act as a symbolic portal between the tomb chamber and the chapel. And these are places where the ka and the ba can go through, right? Those are non-material parts of your being. And so this is a place that allows your ba and your ka to symbolically travel into the area. And all of this is where your afterlife cult is supposed to focus. This is where individuals are supposed to come and make offerings to you, so that you actually, as I said, can continue to live in the next world, because you're living in the next world did require that you had these things, as we've been talking about this whole time. Now, to talk about what the more ordinary person would do, we not only see that they'd be buried with jars of things in their small pit burial, we have some what I think are very endearing clay plates. And these are meant to serve the same function as these beautiful stone offering tables. And we'll see them. They're small. They're made out of clay. It's a clay offering platter that would have different elements on it. So these do seem to indicate that individuals did buy into this system, because why create that poor substitute item if you don't need it? So I think it's good for us to go ahead and end it there. The next thing that we would talk about with this, if this was a big full lecture or if we wanted to break this up into multiple podcasts, would of course be the evolution of tomb architecture. I don't want to talk too much about tomb architecture and its development over time, just because that's another huge subject on its own. But I do want to talk about some of the different mummification types of techniques that I hinted at the beginning. So throughout this podcast, we've talked about the ideal process of mummification. And we spent more time talking about the actual reasons you need mummification than we have about mummification itself. So let's go into some of the fun, down and dirty aspects of mummification. Well, we already talked about the need to remove your brains, but this gets into one of the best aspects of mummification that isn't talked about that much. A lot of the times we can see that the priests doing this were not, one, that careful, or two, just did really shoddy jobs of mummifying individuals. So for instance, we can see mummies, and this is all because of the modern technology that we're using to look at them now. We can see the CT scans that show us, hey, these individuals didn't have their internal organs removed like they were supposed to, or they didn't actually go in and remove the brains. We see again that for a high-class mummification, we're going to have the soaking in natron. That probably didn't happen for most people, certainly not for 70 days. For some individuals, they used cheats or workarounds. We see that they would take bags of natron and they would place this inside the cavity of the body to help dry it out. So rather than soaking the solution for a long time and then draining it, maybe soaking it again, it's almost akin to packing the body with salt, that's going to dry out all of that internal viscera. We've got canopic jars with nothing in them, and not appearing that they were emptied in antiquity, but really appearing as though the individual who was buried, they never removed those organs, or if they did, they just threw them away and never put them inside. One of my favorite grosser tales about mummification is we see that at some point, and this is in later periods, they would take a corrosive solution and they would give this to the deceased as an enema. They would then plug them up, let that stew for a bit where it would liquefy all of their internal organs. They would remove the plug and just let everything drain out. So I think that it's good to really juxtapose the first part of the podcast where we talked about all of the reasons for this and all of the sentiment behind it, which is beautiful and touching, I think, examples of the human condition, that individuals are afraid of the end of this life, that they're struggling for meaning, that they want life to go on. And in the case of the Egyptians, how they conceived of that afterlife and what they needed to do for it. But then we also see, again, linked to this aspect of social constructs, that this is a business for many of the priests who are engaged in this, that they're not taking the care with it that we should have, or I should say not all of them. Because one of the other beautiful things that we do see is when things start to get bad at the end of the New Kingdom. And the New Kingdom ends, you know, we're talking about 1100, 1050 before the Common Era. We start to see more systematic looting, I think, of the New Kingdom tombs, perhaps by the kings themselves, perhaps by the workmen. Likely some of these individuals are all acting together. But we actually see that some of the royal mummies are taken out of their tombs and hidden in these caches. So we see that in what I think is a beautiful sentiment, priests, in all likelihood, are preserving these bodies. We have horrible examples where we can see of grave robbers. So, for instance, the Queen Nefertari, who we spoke about, the great wife of Ramses II, I believe with her, we don't have anything left more than, you know, her kneecaps, I believe, and maybe part of her lower legs below that, because individuals would simply go in and hack up the mummies to get at some of these jewels and these objects, like the heart scarab we talked about, that would be placed within the wrappings, or amulets that might have been buried with the individual. So we see that some of the royal mummies were hidden to protect them. We also see that in the more modern era, mummies have enjoyed a really interesting and storied history. We see that there's a belief in Arabic society in the Middle Ages that mummies had certain magical powers. Alchemists would use ground up mummy as an ingredient in certain spells. It was even in certain tonics, it was supposed to have thought to have healing properties. Mummies were seen as something of a novelty item. And one of the things we see is that when individuals started in the 19th century going to Egypt, they would come back from that holiday with a mummy, and they would have a mummy unwrapping party. They would remove the bandages to see which amulets were inside, which objects were inside, and that this was something that was common that individuals in the society did. One other thing we start to see that's really sad, because who knows how many we've lost, is that mummies are simply burned. They make excellent, in many cases, kindling or firewood. One of the things that we start to see used in the production of mummies is they're dried out, of course. But then to make the body a little bit more pliable, they would often massage into the mummy, or again, they were supposed to, different types of oils, different types of resins. And one of the things that we see is really common with these is they would use cedar oil, for instance. A lot of the mummies I've been around actually have that type of a cedary smell. They would also use bitumen, which is an oily tar-like substance that they would use to help preserve these bodies. And we can see then that when you're taking something that's extremely dry, soaking it, or at least applying oils to it and resins and flammable materials, and then wrapping it in linen, that after it then sits like that for a few millennia, it's going to be something that burns really easily. And we have plenty of evidence that many of them were burned, simply some out of necessity, simply because they were good for that. Much the same way that many of the buildings that we had from ancient Egypt that survived into the 19th, 20th century were destroyed because they were made out of mud brick. And mud brick is made from really very rich earth. So that earth would still be good, still be rich. They would break it up, use it as fertilizer. So I think that's going to help to conclude our podcast for today. Nice, not too long podcast about mummification. Again, I didn't just want to talk about how they prepared the bodies and what they did to them. I wanted to give you a sense of why they did it, because I think that is really the more interesting thing. Why these individuals were driven to preserve these bodies. What was the reasoning behind it? That is, to me, more fascinating than how they did it. Of course, the how they did it is interesting as well. Thank you for listening to this episode of Eric's Guide to Ancient Egypt. I truly appreciate you taking the time to listen to the podcast. If you like the podcast, please subscribe to it and rate and review the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever format you listen to it on, if they allow that. If you have any questions or any feedback you'd like answered on the podcast, please, you can feel free to get in contact with me on ericsguidetoancientegypt.com, or also through our Facebook page, Eric's Guide to Ancient Egypt, or on Twitter at Eric's Egypt. I also have an audience survey on my Twitter and Facebook pages, so if you'd like to give me any suggestions or feedback there, please feel free, and thanks for listening.